My name is Jennifer Whitney, and I'll tell you a little more about myself in a bit, but I wanted to start with a go-around, and if people could say their name and where they're from, and in 5 words or less, say what you know or what you think you know or what sorts of impressions you have about what happened in Seattle when we shut down the WTO. So my name's Jennifer, I'm from Seattle, and I thought it was the most exciting festival of resistance, revolutionary festival of resistance.
Can I just strikes me as the diversity of people that took part and finding myself in the Infinity Group with two Quakers and two people who believed in armed revolution and being completely comfortable with that was just an extraordinary experience.
Let's see. I'm here as an individual. I work with the Direct Action Network, but I can't at all represent the Direct Action Network. I'm just going to give you my perspective and my take on things. Anyone that you talk to in Dan would have, you know, slightly or wildly varying things, so I just want to put that out, that little disclaimer out. I organized nearly full-time for 3 months leading up to the mass action. And that was the first mass action that I had participated in the organizing of. And so that's my other disclaimer, that my experience is somewhat limited. And Seattle is sort of what I am, that's my reference point, really. My main roles in the organizing were, the primary thing I did was I organized the medical teams and a free clinic that provided all sorts of different treatment for, the clinic was open for 7 days before the action and then for 5 days during the action. And organized the clinic and then also organized medical teams that were out on the streets and that I organized the trainings so people would be able to take care of each other. I kind of predicted that the police response was going to be so heavy-handed, and so had people trained to decontaminate people from tear gas and pepper spray exposure, and the trainings were just covering very basic first aid stuff. I also participated in coordinating the street theater and making a lot of the puppets and banners and things. Worked on what we called the scenario working group, which was the group that really created the action, you know, the different components, how the processions would fit in, how we would actually shut down the WTO. And I was in a marching band that, what I know of the Samba band that with RTS, we played a similar function in terms of moving people to strategic areas. And so that's where I'm coming from having been involved in those different components. What I'd like to talk about, and I just want to run over it really quickly so people have a sense of what's going to happen today or this morning. I want to talk a little bit about Dan and how it was started, talk about how the organizing, how it began, how it developed, the convergence itself, which was a 10-day gathering, a little bit about affinity groups and spokes councils, and go on into talking about peacekeepers and how we made decisions about having them, not having them. And then I'll show, the spokes council will actually have a little mock spokes council so people can get a sense of how it functions and what it looks like. We won't be making any major decisions though, I promise. And unless people want to plan an action in 10 minutes, then we can certainly try. Then I'll show a little bit of a video to get some non-police images into your minds about Seattle, and then have an evaluation. And I've got a lot of information that I would sort of like to download, and I would really like it if people would stop me if I'm going too quickly, or if I'm using lingo that doesn't make sense, or if I'm sounding way too American and you want me to sort of translate into British terms or whatever. Just please, you know, just wave your hand frantically and stop me. I don't want people to sit there being lost and feeling like they shouldn't speak up. Okay. The Direct Action Network, its full name is the Direct Action Network Against Corporate Globalization. And it came together, the idea sort of was bouncing around in May, and then it was formally pulled together in July. And we had several co-sponsors that that signed on saying that they would provide resources, whether it be financial or use of photocopying, or that they would mobilize their members of their organizations or provide legal support. And the role for Direct Action Network was to organize the direct action component, the shutdown of the WTO, as well as to mobilize people all around the country and did some international coordination as well. We organized the convergence, the 10-day planning space that Rowan mentioned. And the way in which we wanted to work was to really create models of how we want the world to look like. We wanted to create festivals. We wanted to be making art and to really have to create our ideal world in the process of organizing this action. So we weren't just talking about it, but we were really living it. The idea of using art and culture as a tool of transformation was very key throughout the organizing and throughout the actual action. The organizing really kicked off with a camp. About 100 people went to a camp that was put on by the Ruckus Society, which is an organization that they do training camps in direct action techniques such as lockdowns and banner hangs. They also do media trainings, and that's pretty much the basic thing. They get lots of funding from lots of different anonymous donors, and then distribute it to different, they'll go into a city, do an action camp, and then help people do their action in the local area. So that the Ruckus camp happened, and it was there that people really began the planning. They started the initial vision of what sorts of tactics we would use, and really put out a framework, which was then filled in over the course of the following months. And many of the details were left until the very end, so as more and more people arrived in town, they could plug in and still contribute. So it wasn't completely planned out in advance, but there was a definite framework. We had general meetings, which were basically a place where new people could come, find out what was going on, and hook up with established working groups. There were maybe 15 or 20 different groups that were covering all sorts of logistics in terms of finding us a space for the convergence, finding housing, planning the scenario, medical, street theater, et cetera, et cetera. There's, for a lot more detailed information, I have a zine that's about the Seattle logistics, and rather than going into all of the intricacies now, I recommend that people look at this. We've got a few copies here, and then people can certainly just flip through it. So the general meetings were happening in Seattle and also all around the country. People were coming together and starting to form their affinity groups pretty early on. We had conference calls every other week to coordinate with some of these other cities, particularly cities like Portland, which came up with an entire cluster of affinity groups of about 150 people that were just ready to plug in anywhere. And then some, we were coordinating with them, and then also with some cities that just had a few people that weren't really sure. So we were just trying to keep people informed of what we were doing the whole time. We used a lot of internet organizing as well. The working groups were formed, they were probably really consolidated by the end of September, early October. And it was around that time that we created a body that we called the Organizing Collective. And that was, it was basically the decision-making body for the Direct Action Network, and it consisted of representatives not even representatives, spokespeople from each of the working groups and also from each of the co-sponsoring groups. So those meetings would look, you know, there would be a person from the food, a person from the medical team, a person from the logistics, from the housing, et cetera, and people would come together, bring proposals that their group had had, and everyone would discuss them and take that back to their working groups, get consensus on it, bring it back, and decisions would be made that way. So it was, we tried to make it as open as possible. And I think one of the things that we definitely learned from that was that as more and more people were coming into town, they didn't have a sense of how that was functioning, and it looked like a very closed system, and we weren't making it, I guess we weren't publicizing it so clearly that anyone could come to these meetings. They weren't open for anyone to come. If you joined a working group, then you could that way get your input into the meetings. There wasn't room for people that weren't a part of a group. So that was some pretty heavy criticism that we received, that it seemed very cliquish. And that was quite frustrating, since it was in fact open, but you know, it's only as open as you put it out to be, so.
So can I just clarify, yes. Is that a spokes council of working groups, if you like?
Basically, yeah. Yeah, except the difference was that we didn't meet with the entire spokes council, we just met with the spokes. So in a spokes council meeting, it would have looked like all of those spokespeople and all of the groups sitting sort of behind their spokespeople and then communicating through. We just had sort of the inner ring at these meetings. But many people would come from each working group, and then one person would be the speaker and other people would be there to give input. The organizing collective meetings were always open to anyone, but then the actual decision making was limited to the spokespeople.
Can I make a comment?
Yes, please.
Well, just coming in 3 days before the Tuesday, when the main action started to pick up, I was able to join an affinity group, go through the trainings, and be part of that organisational structure. I found it very easy to, I mean, yeah, easy to slip into that process, and I felt that I had a voice in that, you know, I had an input in it, so I don't understand the criticism that people had.
Do you have any input on that?
No, because we didn't try and get involved in that spokes council.
So there were really two almost separate, I mean, it kind of felt separate, components that we were planning. There was the action and there was the convergence. And what happened during the convergence, we rented a pretty large building that had been a dance club before. And so it had lots of large open spaces. And then we had the parking garage that was connected to that space. And we had several other workspaces as well, but they were scattered around the city and ended up not being quite as useful as they might have been. We had one building that was used for housing, but it was logistically difficult to get people to and from. We didn't have shuttle systems in place, so people were relying on public transit, and it was a little bit tricky. So in retrospect, I would definitely have tried to get more spaces within walking distance of each other. But so this convergence site, it was called 420, because that was the address of it, 420 East Anyway. And what was going on there was...
What music is it?
Oh. I don't remember.
It's really kind of
That's it.
It was huge, yeah. Sorry, I can't really be specific about it. We had between 3,500 people in and out of the room, which was way too many, but I mean, we all fit. The space was open from 8 a.m. until midnight, and it was used as a welcome center for people to get there, get oriented, get maps of the city, public transportation information, you know, meet up with their friends. There was a big message board and a ride board and, you know, all sorts of little ways people could network with each other. And there was some space in the beginning parts of the convergence that were good, just kind of hangout space. There was a little tea house. And once the weekend before the action arrived, we had to sort of cut back the hangout space because it was needed for workshops and trainings. But it was really the core. It was, you know, people would come there, find their friends, and then go off to do their reconnaissance or whatever they needed to do. It was very much the networking hub. We were open for 10 days before the convergence, and then 10 days before the action, and then 5 days during the action. And what was going on there? There was we served a very light breakfast in the morning, and then 2 full hot meals during the day. We were probably feeding about 3,000 to 3,500 a day. Well, during the weekend, in the last 4 or 5 days of the action. There was a clinic which was providing both sort of allopathic style medicine as well as acupuncture, massage, herbal medicine, homeopathy. And so people were able to eat and get healthcare for free. We requested that people make a $10 donation for each day that they were participating in the convergence, but it was sliding scale. No one was turned away at all if they didn't have the money.
Was the catering done by professionals?
The food was done by a group that's called Seeds of Peace, and they formed their collective out of the beginning stages of the Nevada test site actions. And they've been providing food for actions for 10 years or so, maybe. I'm not sure when they actually started, but they're a collective. They get most of their food donated, and they're sort of an autonomous group that it's almost like, you know, cooks for hire. They'll go into different cities and do actions. They do the ruckus training camps that I mentioned earlier. One thing that's happening right now is a lot of groups are sort of coming together and trying to form similar models. There's a legal team that's just recently formed, came out of the WTO legal team. They're called the Midnight Special Law Collective, and they're also going around and doing legal trainings and support in different actions. A similar medical collective is in the process of forming, and so we're hoping to be able to have lots of little autonomous groups that can go and do this and hook in with local support and resources and learn from them what the local politics are of food or healthcare or legal stuff, and then provide our experience from having done the actions. the schedule for each day was In the morning, we had the organizing collective meetings, and just we had them daily once the convergence started to just check in, find out what people's needs were for the day, how we could support each other, what sorts of challenges were predicted. The second half of the convergence, we ended up stopping having those meetings, and that was another huge mistake. People just started feeling like they didn't have time for the meetings and couldn't come together to do that. And the attendance was getting smaller and smaller, and we ended up just dissolving them, which caused lots of chaos towards the end. But it was quite well functioning for a while. So that was the beginning of the day. Then from 9 until around noon were trainings. There were medical trainings, there were nonviolent direct action trainings, legal trainings that were dealing with jail and court solidarity, and we had special legal trainings for internationals and for minors who wanted to participate in the action. There were lockdown trainings, climbing and banner hang trainings.
I don't really know what lockdown is. Is it the same as lockdown?
Yeah. Okay. So those were all trainings that had been planned in advance. We also had a place where people could sign up to offer trainings, and those were very ad hoc, and you would have to find your own space in which to do them. But we had an enormous number of smaller trainings that were being given autonomously. Then we would have lunch, and the afternoons, there was a four-hour block of time that was used for sort of ongoing working groups. And so, for example, the street theater people would all go and make puppets and banners and have meetings planning, you know, the whole theater piece. There was a group that was doing choreography and figuring out how they were going to incorporate people on the streets to do mass coordinated movements together. There was a group that was doing spoken word and hip-hop trainings. There were several... spoken word,
rap,
and hip hop, what's that?
Style of music.
Follow popular entertainment, my lord, involving the spoken word and a rhythmic beat.
Well said. Basically, that training looked like people doing coordinated clapping and using their bodies to make noises and to provide a rhythm, and then people sort of rapping on top of that. What else? I mean, that time was really key in making the art happen on the 30th, and providing some continuity to people's days, because you'd be working with the same people for 4 hours each day. A lot of the affinity groups were formed out of those sorts of working things. And affinity groups also came out of the trainings, especially the direct action trainings and the legal trainings. Some people came to Seattle with their affinity groups already in place. They'd been working together for years. And the vast majority of people came not having a group and formed up while there. After these ongoing working groups, we had an hour that was allotted for affinity group meetings, and that was yet another time where people could wander around and find other people wandering around and form groups just spontaneously like that. And it was also a time where affinity groups could coordinate with, we were really encouraging each group to have someone get trained in medical, and if they were unable to, then they could come to the clinic, and we had a list of medics that were wanting to join groups. So our idea was that each affinity group would be completely autonomous. They would have communication links into the big network of communication. They would have their own medics, and they would do all of their planning autonomously. So there was no one person that had any idea what was going to happen on the 30th, each group. You know, some people were doing more high-risk action, and they didn't tell anyone what they were planning. And it enabled people to really to go pretty deep with their own ideas and not just sort of show up looking for something to do on the morning of the 30th.
What would happen if someone did show up, say, on the morning of the 30th, having done the conversions?
All sorts of things. I mean, people often would just sort of join up with affinity groups, you know, in process, maybe not even knowing that that's what they were doing, but they would just find a group that they wanted to be with and that they were comfortable with. Some people just were running around with their friends, you know, looking at everything, seeing what was going on. A lot of people came down alone and were inspired to go and do blockades, you know, support people who were locked down already.
There was also a procession that started later, mm-hmm. wasn't
there? Yeah.
It was after the pieces of time. Are you going to explain about these
things? Yeah.
And also, just as a point of information, I've got an interview with a young woman who had never done direct action before in her life and didn't go through any of these trainings or attend a convergence, who got swept up in the actions, had everything that the police were throwing at her, and ended up 5 years in five days in jail with all the other people. And I interviewed her a couple of days after she came out and asked her things like, would you do it again? And her reply was, in a heartbeat. So, if anyone wants to listen to that, so.
This is impossible to answer, but roughly, if you could draw a line around the direct action bit, around the dam bit, which you can't, what portion of the people inside that line would have been in affinity groups that had organised before the day? Third, half, two-thirds,
third. I have no idea. I mean, that's part of the beauty of affinity groups, is that no one really knows.
But you said there were about 3,000 people in the space at one time, 4,000 people, so that suggests that was a kind of...
There were probably 5,000 coming through each day. Not all at once, ever. But then the same people were coming back, you know, every day.
I don't know whether this is helpful, but I was at one intersection all day, with quite a small number of people, really, compared with some of the intersections. And I had a sense that maybe about a third of the people at my intersection were part of an affinity group.
So the idea about it wasn't mandatory to be part of the affinity group.
We strongly encouraged it because, I mean, having that many people out in the streets can be so disorienting and confusing, especially for people that were from out of town and weren't familiar with Seattle. An action of that intensity can be really scary, can be really lonely, especially if you're lost and you're not a local, you're not running into your friends everywhere you go or whatever. So we really wanted people to have that, both so they could be really effective and make decisions quickly, and also so they would have some sense of protection in the community.
What proportion would you say were local and what proportion came from out of town?
Indeed from abroad.
Hard to say again. I would guess maybe around 150, 200 from abroad, but I certainly didn't meet everyone. I don't know. Plus there was, I mean, in addition to the Direct Action Network, there were all sorts of other groups that were organizing and bringing people there. I think in terms of, well, yeah.
What were the other major groups that were organizing?
Let me finish answering your question. I don't think I did. Can you repeat it?
I was just wondering how many people were local to sort of Seattle and surrounding areas and how many have traveled.
Okay. Maybe a third local, again, wild guessing, on Tuesday. But what ended up happening was, because the police response was so heavy, and then what happened on the second day of the actions, on Wednesday, was so extreme that the citizens of Seattle that had not been active before were infuriated, and they came down to the streets. So Wednesday it might have been half and half. And many people went to jail on Wednesday, 600. And Thursday and Friday, even more locals were coming out. And so Thursday and Friday, I would say it was much higher percentage of locals than out-of-towners. People were really, really radicalized. The police were going up into people's neighborhoods and gassing and pepper spraying and arresting people for no reason. And, you know, people were up in arms about it. Not literally. And Sarah, what was your question?
You said other groups were
right,
organizing. What kind?
There's the Rainforest Action Network, which is an environmental group. There was 50 Years is Enough, which is a group that's been working against the IMF and the World Bank. What else?
Unions.
Right, the unions very much so. There was a large union rally on the 30th at noon, and there were about 50,000 people there. The what happened on Tuesday in the early part of the morning, I mean, way before, the goal, of course, was to shut the organization's meetings down. And so people came out at 4 in the morning, 3 in the morning, who knows, to set up their blockades. And then at 7 in the morning, there were two processions that started on opposite ends or opposite sides of the convention center where the ministerial was taking place. And so those processions came together.
This is the first day of the...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the first day of the WTO meetings. Those processions came together, and out of the processions came other actions, other lockdowns, and a tripod was set up. And that was another place where individuals were plugging in. They would just go to these meeting points. They were in two parks, and we publicized them very widely beforehand. So people knew just to show up at the park at 7 and then process to, you know, the action area. The meetings were scheduled to start at 9. And then the labor march, the rally started at 10, and then the labor march started at noon. And their plan was to come from the north end of the city, quite far from where the heart of the action was taking place. They planned to come up to the very edge of the action and then sort of go one block over and then head back away. So they weren't at all planning on coming in to the thick of things. And I learned later from some of the police reports that are coming out that the police were talking about having the union march sort of sweep away the direct action folks and take them into this holding area where they could then just be dispersed. They didn't even attempt that, but that was one of their little strategies. What ended up happening was when the union folks got to sort of the end of the line where they were supposed to go and turn around, an enormous amount of them, and I can't estimate numbers, but I would say a few thousand, they broke through their lines. You know, they had people telling them to turn, and they said, no, we're going in with the action. Like, we're supporting these people on the streets. This is where we belong. So that was quite exciting. That's never, you know, there's never been that kind of connection before.
How did the ACA afterwards react? I mean, did they support the blockade, even though that they got their marshals to turn people away from it?
They were pretty positive about it. I mean, sort of what happened in the end is everybody wanted to kind of take credit for it. And so everyone, you know, all these organizations that we've never heard of are coming out and saying, you know, we organized the shutdown. they weren't going that far, but they made a lot of public statements about, you know, how brave we were and how exciting it was. And they definitely supported it. I'm not sure how they interacted with the individuals that did that.
Could you explain who they are?
The AFL. Yeah. It's the AFL is the American Federation of Labor, and the CIO.
I see.
So they're the major coordinating body for the trade unions. Where was I? I was actually still on the schedule.
Sidewalk. How many people did you have doing this lockdown at 7 a.m. in the morning?
A lot.
Like a few thousand or 10,000?
Maybe a few thousand. Yeah. I mean, again, it's hard because no one could ever see everything. So.
You hear all these big numbers thrown around. You wonder actually how many people did it take to shut it down.
Right.
You know, outside
by every morning and rain. I also have a question about numbers, which how many were you in the spokes council when you met?
I'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
George?
Regarding these things, my understanding was actually it was very efficient in terms of occupying key intersections. Mm-hmm. How was it coordinated to make sure that all of the points were covered and there wasn't some weak spot?
I think I should get back to my agenda because a lot of these questions are things that I'm going to get to. So I was talking about the schedule at the convergence, like what each day looked like. After the affinity group meeting times, we had dinner, and then we would have our spokes council meetings, which were the first few days they were I think they were every other day for the first maybe 3 days. And so we would either have spokes council meeting or we would have a night of performance. And there was one night where there was a group of internationals who did a caravan across the country. It was coordinated by People's Global Action. And people from that caravan spoke about the effects of globalization on their countries. So that was in the beginning, and then we had spokes council meetings each night. And it was through the spokes council meetings that the action was really coordinated. Are people familiar with the idea of spokes council meetings? What they looked like there was someone from each affinity group would be a spokes. And the visual of it, well.
Empowered spokesperson is the term, I think.
Right.
Isn't it? Yeah.
There would be an empowered spokesperson from each affinity group, and that person was decided based on their skills of articulation and being concise. And each affinity group would choose one person, and they would speak through that person. So it was pretty important to choose your empowered spokes carefully, so your ideas would get well presented. Because you would. Everyone would sit in a circle, and then each affinity group would line up behind their empowered spokesperson. So it ends up looking like this giant wheel with the spokes coming out. And then you would pass your comments or your bits of information up to the spokes, and then they would say them. So it ended up making it so that you didn't have 700 people all wanting to raise their hand and tell their personal story or whatever. It really kept people's comments to be essential and kept the decision making more streamlined, and yet gave every person who wanted to a chance to put input.
But the comments that went up and down the lines were supposed to be just things like clarification, weren't they? You didn't make decisions in the line. It was just for information or something like that.
Well, but when a decision would have to be made, then each group would discuss it, come to consensus on it, hopefully, and then consensus would be called for the whole group. And so each affinity group would have to reach consensus, and then that person, their empowered spokes would say, we have consensus, or we have a concern, we have a stand aside, whatever was going on within their group. Is this making sense? Am I?
With the groups, obviously you can make a decision in that line, so would the groups fall back and make a decision? Would it then all break out into a circle of your each community and then go back to spokes, or would they make it?
They would do it in the line, usually because there was not the space. These meetings towards the end had maybe 1,500 or 2,000 people in them. Hard to say.
Can we just have a short break to welcome people who've just come in?
George.
Perhaps I should also just say again that what we're trying to do here today, or what the intention was here today, was to bring in people just for the day to a gathering which is actually 4 days long and is trying to create a sense of community. So we're asking people who are coming for the day to be respectful of the fact that we have trying to create a sense of community here, and also for the people who are here for 4 days to welcome and introduce day trippers to what Open Resistance is about. And also that Open Resistance has a tradition of trying to be self-critical and to critique each other, and to do that in a respectful way. And that some people have come here because we've introduced it as a safe space to go really deeply into issues, and to just keep that in mind, that this is going to be a safe space for that.
So what I really would like to do, if people can hold their comments, is go on with the presentation. We're going to have time for questions and discussion after, but we're really short on time. So I'm going to go on to talk about, sort of a concluding thing about the guidelines is that in Seattle, we didn't just have those guidelines. There was a preamble that was published. Everywhere the guidelines were printed, there was a preamble that went with the guidelines, which I'll read really quickly. And for me, it was really key because the guidelines allowed people to participate who were committed principally, morally, et cetera, to nonviolence, and also allowed people who see nonviolence as a tactic that is sometimes very effective and useful and helpful to work together. So people were able to really come together with this agreement that on this day, I'll read the preamble, all participants in this particular action are asked to agree to these action guidelines. Having this basic agreement allows people from many backgrounds, movements, and beliefs to work together. They are not philosophical or political requirements or judgments about the validity of some tactics over others. These guidelines are basic agreements that create a basis for trust so that we can work together for this action and know what to expect from each other. And for me, that was really key in bringing people together. And you know, there were definitely people that had a problem with the guidelines even existing at all, but you know, there were also people who wouldn't have come to the action if not for the presence of guidelines. So it really enabled this truly mass action to happen. In the Spokes Council, we came up with the scenario, as I talked about before. We really fleshed it out. And what we did was we established the convention center where the meetings were taking place. That was sort of ground zero. And from that point, we had radiating all around the city. We had an area that was radiated in sections of, we call them pie slices. So there were little sort of triangular shaped or different shaped wedges all around, numbered 1 through 13. And different groups would commit to taking different sections of the pie. There was one group that I mentioned earlier from Portland who came up knowing exactly what they wanted to do, exactly where they wanted to do it, and they just went ahead and signed on. And what people would do is they would pick a pie slice. They would know, okay, this one contains the entrance to this particular hotel, which has a tunnel that goes to the convention center. So we knew that that hotel was going to be a place where delegates would go from other hotels. They would be shuttled into this one and go through the tunnel to get in. So it was a very key place to blockade. So people would say, okay, the hotel's in this slice. We want that slice. We want to be like on the front lines at this very intense blockade. Other people would take places that were further away that they knew would be a little bit lower risk. And what people would do was sort of assign a flavor to each of the pie slices in terms of high risk, high arrestable situations, very low risk, that sort of thing. I'm not sure if there were other divisions. I think it was primarily based on risk. And then affinity groups that knew each other, like there was a large contingency from San Francisco who worked together for years that are dancers and musicians and puppeteers, and so they would all go in together, and so people knew that there was going to be this mass performance section happening here. So that was decided, and then groups could plug in and sign on to take the different intersections, and it was coordinated through the Spokes Council, and so that prevented, you know, at 5 a.m, 3 groups coming to the same place and scaring the hell out of each other with all of their equipment to lock down or whatever. And really allowed us to disperse evenly over the whole space. So we knew in advance that we already had the perimeter basically secured if we would have access, if we hadn't been blockaded by the police from getting there.
Is that like a list on the wall where people...
There was a big map on the wall.
Right, actually write on it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think,
with
yeah.
The numbers in their groups and the number of people in that group that were going to be arrested.
Right, yeah.
And the police didn't know.
The police were so incredibly stupid. The thing that was really fascinating was, for me, was that we organized totally openly. Our meeting, every meeting was open, except towards the very end, the tactical meetings were closed. I don't really know why. They probably could have been open. But every meeting... The tactical crew came together at the end, and they were the ones that were going to be listening to the communications network, getting information about the police location, communicating that information to affinity groups and clusters, and also coordinating. We had affinity groups that were called flying squads, and those groups were, like the marching band that I was playing with was a flying squad, and so someone would come and tell us, okay, we need people right here, right now, and we would bring people to that intersection. There were lots of different kinds of flying squads, and so the tactical really coordinated, you know, the movement of people in the actual situation. But everything was organized completely openly. We had all of our maps up. You know, it was very clear. We didn't write down, you know, there's going to be a tripod at this intersection. We didn't have the details like that, but it was there. And so we didn't have to be secret because each affinity group was autonomous and wasn't saying in the meetings what they were doing. And they would just say, you know, we'll take care of this intersection, we'll secure this intersection, or whatever.
How was the tactical team chosen? Who got to be on that?
That was chosen from, it came out of the group that had been working on the scenario all along, and it was, that was coordinated where people that had already been in the scenario group could be on the tactical team, and then people that they could definitely vouch for could. But that was one group that wasn't completely open to anyone who wanted to join.
So if I'd wanted to be in tactical team, how might that have been possible for me? Or would it not have been possible for me coming in 3 days before?
It would have been hard coming in 3 days before. One thing that might have worked is if...
Say I'd been around for a month or something like that. How could I have done it then?
You just would have said that you wanted to.
Yeah.
Gone to a scenario meeting or said at a spokes council or talked to people that were on the tactical team. It was tricky. I mean, it was the one area where we did need, you know, some amount of security, or where we felt like we needed it at least. And so it wasn't completely open to everyone. I mean, one thing that people did was sort of get references. Like if you had said, oh, well, I'm a friend of Katya's and then we go way back or something, then that could have worked. Or, you know, a friend of a friend even probably would have worked. So it's...
On that note, a couple of people in my affinity group were quite worried about who I was. So I got my credentials out and showed them Snowball newsletters with my photo on and stuff like that, and that satisfied them.
Just shows you didn't successfully infiltrate the UK movement. Of course you did.
So the other piece of the scenario, I guess I already talked about it, was the two processions, and those were coordinated mostly through the street theater groups. And I don't know if I need to say anything else about the processions. Do people understand how they function? That was where the masses of people came.
We're
so low on time.
I don't want to ask another question. But the processions, some blockades came out. So some of the processions happened and then blockades kind of came out of that. How many?
Don't know.
A lot?
Yeah, probably more than half.
Quite a lot of people in affinity groups were on
the on the processions, yeah. The tripod came out of...
So was it a majority of blockades? Were the majority of blockades set up at 4, 5, 6, 7 a.m.? Or were they in the procession and then came out of that?
I was on the procession. It seemed as though most lockdowns and stuff were already in place.
Yeah. Okay. We had one problem where a tripod that was coming from one side of the convention center and it was disguised as a gigantic carrot. It got confiscated by the police. And I think there were maybe materials for two tripods that got taken. So we only had one tripod that made it in and got set up.
What was that disguised?
Tripod.
Very clever. I can't take questions right now. I don't think, can they be held, or are they really burning and essential to this moment?
I wondered if the two processions were legal.
No, we didn't get permits for anything. No, that was a decision made pretty early on that we would not ask permission to exercise our rights to assemble.
On what basis is that decision?
Because we don't think we need to apply to the state to assemble. It's guaranteed in our constitution. So
as a vibe watcher, she asked to be able to go on without question. Could you please respect that?
Thank you. One thing, this is a pretty controversial one to go into with very little time left. Let's see. There was a decision made pretty early on not to have peacekeepers. Actually, it wasn't made early on. Maybe halfway through the organizing, that we would not have official peacekeepers. And what we decided was that people were going to do whatever felt comfortable for them in the moment. And if somebody was in a space and they saw someone doing something that they thought was inappropriate, they were empowered as an individual to take responsibility for their environment and interact with that person and see what they could negotiate. But we didn't want to have official sanctioned peacekeepers who were then empowered to sort of try and police other people's behavior or control other people's behavior. We wanted people to really take the initiative and not need to be condoned or sanctioned to do that, but able to do it freely in the moment if they felt it was necessary. What ended up happening was at our convergence site, there were a couple of workshops, peacekeeping workshops, and that was a pretty big controversy. A lot of it felt like since we had made this decision, we were not going to have them, then why were we training them? And again, it was determined that, you know, it was sort of an ad hoc group that was doing the trainings, and we couldn't prevent them from doing that. That's what they wanted to do. It was important to them. So it was a tricky issue. A lot of people have a lot of criticism about the way we handled it, and we really felt, my sense is that we really felt that it was, we wanted people to remain as autonomous as possible. And by saying, no, you can't have your peacekeeping workshops, I mean, that would be just as controlling as if we did have peacekeepers out on the streets controlling. So what happened in reality on the streets was that there were several people who sort of took on the role of peacekeeper. And in retrospect, it might have helped if we had had more connection with the trainings that did happen to make sure that people understood the guidelines and the way they functioned. The guidelines sort of took on a life of their own. It was stated clearly that they were to be used for November 30th for this action. And, you know, I saw people on Friday running around, you know, sort of condemning people for violating the guidelines that weren't even, I mean, the guidelines were not to be in place for the rest of the week. It was only for Tuesday. I think that's all I wanted.
Yeah, I got that message very clearly, that it was just for that day, and I was in my affinity group doing actions on that day, and the rest of the day I was doing something else, just wandering about, seeing what was happening, really. So I knew when I was safe and when I wasn't going to feel safe.
And how did you find the rest of the week? Was that scary, as the guidelines went out?
Not really, because I chose not to do anything very full-on on that day. I chose to do all the kind of serious stuff on the first day, and the guidelines were in place, and when I felt secure enough to do them.
I really hope that we can talk a lot more about guidelines and other things in the discussion. I need to move on, though. Another piece, and I don't like flying through this, the peacekeepers were interacting quite sort of head-on with the Black Bloc, and for people who don't know what that is, it's a group of people that come together dressed similarly, wearing black hoods and masks often, and they run around together and provide protection for each other because of the similar dress. They can act, they can do illegal actions and kind of blend back in with the group and be somewhat protected by their group. Do you want to say anything else? It's sort of hard to give a quick rundown of it.
Well, just they've acted independently of Dan, it wasn't passed down. But yeah, it was still condemned by people that were on the Dan action, and even though they had never agreed to any guidelines, which made it really tricky.
And what they were doing, they were damaging property. They weren't, I didn't see them, I don't know, but they weren't, to my knowledge, confronting the police. That's not something that really happens in the States because of our assault laws. You can't even touch a police officer without risking assault charges. So there's really not any kind of history or context for fighting with the police there. And to my knowledge, the Black Bloc was only doing property damage, weren't interacting with other people unless they were challenged. And there were some peacekeepers who took it upon themselves to try and prevent the property damage from happening, and altercations would ensue then. There were definitely instances of peacekeepers attacking people that were trying to do property damage and screaming nonviolence at them, which was an unmasking. And I actually, there was a particular woman who was acting as a peacekeeper, and I saw her on Friday outside of the jail where there was a, you know, 1,000 people or so having a vigil. when she was going and unmasking people and grabbing them by the shoulders and shaking them and yelling at them, and they weren't doing anything. They were just there at the vigil in solidarity with the people who were in jail. They weren't, you know, they weren't doing any property damage. They just were wearing masks. So that's, it's a little tricky. I mean, we don't want to try and control people's behavior, but we don't want other people to be controlling behavior. And this is one of the issues that we're left with, is how can we have a mass action and work with people who want there to be peacekeepers and want some sort of guarantee that space will be safe, and also work with the Black Bloc, and who are not only out there doing property damage, but are also going and backing up lockdowns and providing human barriers to protect people who are in lockdown, putting themselves between the police and the lockdown people. There's been a lot of misconception that the Black Bloc is only out there breaking windows, and you know, many of them were organizing and doing outreach and bringing more people into the action well in advance. It's not like they all just showed up on the day for opportunistic rock throwing or whatever. Yeah, I think I want to go right into the video and
I wonder if we should have a
video after break. It's pretty short, but whatever people want.
Can we ask five watchers what do they think?
The video's about 5 minutes.
Well, how about?
Pardon?
When does the workshop finish?
No.
To me, I'm just concerned about the next lot of workshops.
Right.
Yeah. To me, it looks like the interest is so big that we should maybe, if it's possible, you can have something in the afternoon and then show the video.
The afternoon's pretty full.
Can we have one of these agreement signs? If you agree with what I'm going to say, do that. Do people generally agree?
It's just as a live watcher, that's a big group. That's against our guidelines to make a big group decision.
Well, I'm glad the decision that we, you know, try this one, because we haven't got time to do that.
Not in big groups.
Why can't we make a decision?
Because it's oppressive. It's our own.
We're not going to try and make a decision in a big group, because when you have a big group dynamic, it's quite often that somebody feels that they can't abstract that process. So.
Okay, as a five watcher, I suggest watching the video for 5 minutes. That's what it is, and then having a break in there. Because that's the end of it, is it?